We moved one item out and blew it up, and that worked just fine. So we're hoping to continue that through the rest of the day.
Authorities take care of an abundance of explosive materials at a Chena River cabin. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 27th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reaction to draft changes to the federal contracting program that benefits Native organizations.
I think everybody needs to understand the rural parts of Alaska, the economy there, well, there is none.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
A multi-agency public safety team has begun detonating explosive materials found at a Fairbanks residence. The operation is happening outside a home where Dane Kopanen was injured in a blast earlier this month. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Authorities have released little information about the case since the January 10th blast at the Chena Ridge home sent 20-year-old Dane Kopanen to a Seattle hospital with burns. State Trooper Director Colonel Audie Holloway says Dane Kopanen's residence is cluttered with containers of chemicals, and not all have been identified, but it appears he was making explosives.
It doesn't appear that there was, you know, any intent to hurt anybody, but the construction of some of these things may put many people at risk.
The home where the explosives are is on a large piece of land, but the borough notified residents within a 1 square mile area using a reverse 911 system about the detonation disposal operation. Holloway reported the effort to be moving along successfully Wednesday morning.
We moved one item out and blew it up, and that worked just fine. So we're hoping to continue that through the rest of the day. It's going to really depend on how slowly they have to move and how much stuff that we uncover as we go through. The place is very cluttered. So it may be that we find more stuff. We're not sure. We're trying to get it all out of there.
At a Fairbanks press conference, Holloway said state and federal agencies, including the FBI, ATF, and an ordnance disposal team from Eielson Air Force Base, as well as a robot, were involved in the operation. Holloway would not say what chemicals they're dealing with, but the borough previously identified some, including fertilizer, battery acid, and ethanol. Holloway said the removal and detonation process was being carried out in a slow and deliberate manner, and it wasn't clear how long it would take.
We're erring on the side of caution, because you know you can't just look at something in a bottle and tell what it is. We do know that from the information we've learned in the investigation, that we have to be careful with a lot of stuff in there, because there was just a lot of. He was very active.
Holloway says weapons-related charges are likely to be filed against Kopanen. He says Kopanen, the grandson of former state legislator Nilo Kopanen, is cooperating with authorities in the investigation. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bill being considered in the state house would create a natural reserve along the Holitna River. It would be the first time the legislature creates a reserve for hunting and fishing. The bill is sponsored by Representative Bob Huron, a Democrat from Bethel, along with Representative Mark Newman, a Big Lake Republican. A public hearing on the bill was held yesterday in the House Fisheries Committee. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
House Bill 227 would establish 4 million acres of the Holitna River Basin as a hunting, fishing, and trapping reserve. The language of the bill states that the purpose is to promote management activities, to rebuild or enhance fish and wildlife populations and habitats, to maintain historical and sustainable harvest levels, for continued high levels of human consumptive use of these resources. Greg Rozichka of Bethel was involved with the inception of the idea of a Holitna Reserve 5 years ago, and he explained the purpose this way during the hearing.
You know, you have similar special purpose areas in other sections of the state. Mr. Saxby mentioned about the forestry. Well, here we'd like to establish that assured protection for the hunting, fishing, and trapping values of an area.
The Holitna is a main tributary of the Kuskokwim and a rich fish and game area. It's the spawning ground for many salmon and an important area for moose habitat. If the bill passes, it would be the first time that the state legislature created a hunting and fishing reserve. Reserves are different than refuges, which already exist in the state. A refuge is an area set aside by the state legislature primarily for the protection of fish and game habitat. This reserve would create active management to produce high levels of human consumptive use. At the hearing, several residents and groups from the region spoke in favor of the bill. Doug Carney, chairman of the Stoney-Holitna Fish and Game Advisory Committee, said the committee supports it.
Because it's a sensitive area and it's the most productive. And a lot of people all up and down the Kuskokwim rely on it, particularly for fish.
The Sleetmute Traditional Council said they were in favor of the bill. Mike Tellhauser of Aniak did too. He's the fisheries director with the Kuskokwim Native Association and said the area is vital for not only salmon, but whitefish too.
Very few identified spawning areas for humpback whitefish and for Lee Cisco are located in the Holitna River, and it provides the most significant feeding area for shefish on the Kuskokwim.
Bethel resident Grant Fairbanks said in the last 36 years, he's gone to many meetings, including 9 hearings, about the importance of the Holitna.
This bill will indicate to all that fish and game resource management is the indicated and the best use of this watershed.
Dick Milius, director of the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, was present at the hearing. He said the division does not have any position on the bill, but they do have some concerns.
In terms of how mineral development, oil and gas development, and forestry uses might fit into this area.
Milius said there are some mining claims in the area, and there has been some interest in oil and gas exploration.
The resource experts think it has pretty low potential, but it's largely unexplored.
At the public hearing, it was asked if the bill would establish any user group as a priority. Kevin Saxby with the State Department of Law said no.
This bill establishes production of the fish and game resource as the priority, not a preference for any user group.
The House Fisheries Committee did not take any action on the bill and is holding it for further consideration. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaskans weighed in today on proposed changes to a federal program that's pumped billions of dollars into Native corporations. The Federal Small Business Administration held a meeting in Anchorage on draft changes to the 8A program that provides no-bid contracts to the Native-owned companies. The program came under fire in Congress last year, and SBA Director of the Office of Native American Affairs, Clara Pratt, says the resulting proposed changes are the first the 8A program has seen in 10 years.
It was due for some modification to address concerns of waste, fraud, and abuse across the board from entity-owned and individually-owned 8A companies, as well as, you know, tighten up some of the problems that we had seen.
Pratt says changes are proposed to the criteria used for measuring benefits of government contracts to Native communities and how corporation assets are assessed in determining which companies get contracts. Clyde Gooden, a vice president with Northwest Alaska Regional Corporation, NANA, says there are inequities in how Native companies in Alaska, the lower 48, and Hawaii are treated within the program.
Parity is something that it has to be looked at. Right now, there is a difference. We do have a different ability to negotiate with the federal government on opportunities than, as an example, the NHOs, the Native Hawaiian organizations. And then, you know, that's indigenous people over there that should be treated the same as us here in Alaska.
Gooden says the overall program is very valuable and important to Native people and should continue. He says Native companies, especially in Alaska, deserve special treatment because of the people they benefit.
You know, a lot of folks look at us and say, geez, why are you getting these preferences? Well, I think everybody needs to understand the rural parts of Alaska, the economy there, well, there is none.
The 8A contract program has drawn criticism for funneling very little of the billions in contracts back to Native people in the form of dividends. Gooden says Alaska Native corporations have had to invest a lot to ramp up their operations to handle the contracts, and much of their face value does not equate to immediate profit and dividends. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a steady increase in the state's population.
Right now, Alaskans are saying to themselves, well, you know, I may have wanted to go somewhere else, but time ain't right.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
When Interior Secretary Salazar announced there would be an overhaul of the federal subsistence management system in Alaska last year, hearings were conducted to gather comments from resource users. Pat Porchot is Secretary Salazar's special assistant for Alaska Affairs. He says Interior officials have met with dozens of groups and individuals around the state.
We went to the Yukon Delta, Kotzebue area, Fort Yukon. We held lots of meetings with both rural and non-rural folks in Fairbanks and Anchorage, traveled through Southeast.
Porchot says comments were wide-ranging, but a common complaint was that rural users didn't have a role in decision-making. There was concern that federal subsistence board members were not familiar with subsistence use and made decisions without good knowledge of traditional uses in Alaska. People said the regional advisory councils, or RACs, were not being paid attention to. When the system was designed, the 10 RACs were supposed to gather input from locals, craft recommendations, and send them to the federal board for consideration.
And over time, people have criticized that process as reducing the participation and influence of the regional advisory councils.
Porchot says some rural residents feel the state is exerting undue influence on the federal subsistence program. Another problem raised by rural residents is the confusing nature of the overlapping authority between state and federal managers. The state manages all state and private lands, including Native Corporation lands. The federal government manages subsistence uses on federal lands, but parks, refuges, and BLM land that is open to hunting is managed by the state. Porchot says some want the state to change its constitution to comply with Title VIII of ANILCA that gives rural residents priority. Some, he says, argue the opposite, saying it is right and proper for the Fed to follow ANILCA.
No one argues that this dual management is the most efficient or effective way of managing wildlife or fishery resources, but that's the situation we find ourselves in when the state did not comply with ANILCA.
Porchot says it's timely to conduct this review because when the system was put in place nearly two decades ago, it was anticipated it would be temporary and the state would regain management in the near future.
And I think now, 18 years later, we are definitely in it for the long haul, and that we should be looking at what's the most effective and efficient way of managing subsistence on federal lands for the long term.
Porchot says he's hopeful that recommendations can be compiled in a report and given to Secretary Salazar by February. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has extended the deadline to apply for seats on the 10 regional advisory councils that advise the Federal Subsistence Board. The councils meet twice a year. Applicants must be knowledgeable about fish and game uses in their regions. The deadline has been extended to February 16th. Alaska is the 47th most populous in the U.S., with 692,000 residents in 2009. That's a 10% population increase over the decade, according to data from the Alaska Department of Labor. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Alaska's growth has primarily been through natural increase, the number of people born here minus those who die. State demographer Greg Williams says the small influx of people to the state is greatly influenced by the military. That's been true for the last two decades.
Both decades have been influenced fairly heavily by what has happened with our military populations. You know, in the 90s, we had various base closures. And in this decade, with our wars, we've had more military coming back in and moving around. And we are the second highest military state in the country after Hawaii in terms of the proportion of military independence.
Alaska population figures include troops stationed here who are deployed overseas. Labor economist Neil Fried attributes some recent population changes to the economic recession, worse in the lower 48 than in Alaska.
There's a normal kind of flow between us and the rest of the country, but that flow changes when economic opportunity changes. And right now, Alaskans are saying to themselves, well, you know, I may have wanted to go somewhere else, but the time ain't right because it looks ugly down there. So that's a powerful force. And that might even be more powerful than the fact that there are some people that are saying, things are better in Alaska than they are here in moving to Alaska.
Between 2008 and 2009, estimates indicate only 2,261 people moved into the state, most to Anchorage. It now has 42% of Alaska's population, more than 290,000 people. But over the decade, the Matanuska-Susitna Valley has been the fastest growing region. While Freed says a disproportionate number of people who move to Alaska settle in that region, there's also been an influx of residents from other parts of the state. Matsu has some local economy, but Freed says it also has distinct characteristics of a bedroom community.
They're a bedroom community to Anchorage, but I think it's also important that they're a bedroom community to a good portion of the rest of the state. You know, they supply one of the biggest parts of the North Slope workforce, for example, and, you know, other places as well.
In other parts of the state, most of the population changes over the decade were due to natural increase. The Fairbanks North Star borough grew by nearly 11,000 people. In southwest Alaska, only a few more people were born than moved away. More people left the North Slope borough than were born. Williams says some parts of southeast, including the capital city, grew only slightly in the last year of the decade. But over the 10 years, there's been no long-term growth.
The aging of our baby boom population has certainly contributed, for instance, to some of the declines we see in southeast, since we have one of the oldest populations in the state in terms of median age. The fact that most of the baby boomers' kids have now left school and have gone off to whatever post-secondary lives they may have means that we're going to have less natural increase to compensate for migration.
The median age in southeast is 39 years old, compared to the statewide median age of 33.5 years old. The population estimates are compiled from State of Alaska Permanent Fund Dividend and Vital Statistics data, surveys of group quarters such as the Pioneer Homes and prisons, and Williams says international migration and state population data comes from the U.S. Census Bureau. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
Six Alaska legislators want the governor to reinstate a Southeast environmental activist to a cruise ship science panel. Gershon Cohen of Haines was named to the Department of Environmental Conservation Advisory Committee earlier this month. Commissioner Larry Hartig removed Cohen a short time later, saying he was too much of an advocate to sit on an impartial panel. Hartig says he made his decision after hearing complaints from the tourism industry. Two senators and four representatives sent a letter yesterday to Governor Sean Parnell objecting to what they call corporate abuse. House Minority Leader Beth Krutula, a Juneau Democrat, signed the letter. It says the administration caved into lobbying from the cruise ship industry, which has battled with Cohen for years.
It seems to have been done with no good reason for it, and quite possibly because of industry pressure. And that's just really disturbing and wrong. And this isn't the way to have the state government treat people.
Senators Bill Willikowski and Hollis French and Representatives Berta Gartner, Mike Dugan, and Les Guerra signed the letter. All are Anchorage Democrats. Cohen co-sponsored a 2006 Citizens Initiative that increased regulation of cruise ship wastewater discharges. The six lawmakers say he's qualified for the panel because he has advanced degrees in biology and environmental policy. The six represent only a tenth of the state legislature. Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman has no objection to Cohen's removal.
You know, you serve on these committees at the discretion of the governor, it's my understanding. So if the governor isn't comfortable with an appointment, he can certainly change that. I'm not privy to the information the governor has, but, you know, if you're biased or viewed to be biased heavily one side or the other, normally you don't make the best appointee.
The Science Advisory Panel was created last year by legislation delaying the new wastewater discharge rules. Its 11 members will advise the state on technologies that could help cruise lines meet the standards.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Alaska Communication Systems. Whether your business operations are in Alaska, nationally or internationally, ACS has the network solution to keep you and your business connected. ACSAlaska.com.
Yukon River salmon stocks are the key topic for the State Board of Fish at a meeting in Fairbanks this week. The State Fish Board is facing some 70 proposals for changes to the way it handles fisheries in the Arctic Yukon-Kuskokwim region, and more than half have to do with the Yukon River salmon. Regional Commercial Fisheries Manager John Linderman says recent weak Yukon King salmon runs have inspired a lot of proposals.
There's a lot of controversy out there, and that's definitely going to increase the level of interest to try and address those issues.
Linderman says there are a number of proposals that deal with the gear types fishermen use to catch salmon. He says one idea is to limit the size of net mesh openings to decrease bycatch of kings. Another proposal is aimed at limiting the incidental catch of kings during weak runs and calls for making it illegal to sell those fish.
Taking away the monetary motivation, because even if I catch kings, I'm not going to be able to sell them. That gives that additional protection, I guess you'd call it, to the Chinook salmon run.
If the proposal passes, bycatch kings could only be used for subsistence. Another proposal before the board deals with Yukon chums and coho. The state proposal would permit late-season commercial silver fishing in years of weak fall chum runs.
Once the majority of the fall chum salmon run has passed through, but we have a surplus and a good run of coho salmon, you would be able to fish for those coho salmon commercially, even though you still might be harvesting a few of those remaining fall chum salmon.
The tactic was tried as an emergency measure last fall, and Linderman says it was fairly successful. The Fish Board meets through Sunday at the Fairbanks Princess Hotel. Angoon's mayor says he's willing to include other southeast communities in development of a controversial hydropower project near Petersburg, but he won't give up a federal permit that gives his town control of the Ruth Lake effort. That's despite pressure from legislators and some community members concerned that the effort could jeopardize a hydro project closer to home. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Angoon is a largely Tlingit village on Admiralty Island, about halfway between Juneau and Sitka. Its 450 or so residents pay high rates for diesel-generated electricity and have one of the region's highest levels of unemployment. Those problems have been part of City Council debates this month about the community's role in a controversial hydroelectric development about 70 miles to the southeast.
The council is looking to the future and trying to find solutions to future problems as well as taking care of today's business.
Albert Howard is Angoon's mayor and part of a city council majority that supports developing Ruth Lake.
The reason we took a look at it and decided it would be an advantage is it would bring revenue into the city of Angoon. It wasn't ever intended to bring electricity here, although that is possible if we get the intertie.
Angoon beat out Petersburg and Wrangell last year for the initial federal permit needed to develop the large and expensive project. It also won the same type of permit toward developing nearby Scenery Lake. They're two of several potential hydro sites at Thomas Bay, about 15 miles northeast of Petersburg. Angoon is also interested in a smaller, cheaper hydropower project being developed much closer to town by its village native corporation.
I can't see people are in power in either the federal grants or in the state grants, look at two Angoon projects and say, shall we fund both of them?
Angoon's Albert Kukesh represents the community and more than 100 others in the state senate.
I see the possibility of one project getting funded. And the one that's right in our backyard in Angoon is a Thayer Lake project, which was congressionally granted. Coots New Inc. owns the land in there and the property and the right to develop that. And it would eventually provide low-cost electricity to the residents of Angoon without much of a transmission line.
Kukesh wrote Angoon City Council asking it to drop its interest in Ruth Lake. He said lawmakers would not support Thayer Lake unless the community allows Petersburg to take the lead on the larger project. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman, who writes most of the legislature's capital budget, says his support is not tied to Angoon dropping the larger project. But he says there's no way state money will go to Angoon's Ruth Lake plan. Howard, the Angoon mayor, says the two hydro projects are separate. He says the city is not involved in Thayer Lake, though it does support the effort. He has no plans to turn Ruth Lake over to anyone, but he's willing to share management.
That was just an option. I mean, we've taken a good look at other options. We've always, you know, there's always a solution to a problem. So one of them was to share it with Kate, Petersburg, and Wrangell and have a four-way deal on it.
Angoon officials are working with staff from the private company Cascade Creek on the Ruth Lake project, and that's part of the controversy. Former Mayor Maxine Thompson says the company persuaded village leaders into an expensive and dangerous investment.
Our community cannot afford to build another project for somebody's personal gain. And when I say somebody, I don't even know who that somebody is. And our community needs to see this, these people. You know, what are they bringing to the table? From what we see at present, we are being led by others for the benefit of their interests.
Cascade Creek, with offices in Juneau and Washington State, is pursuing several other hydro projects in the area. It wants to serve Southeast markets as well as sell electricity to the mainland power grid in cooperation with Angoon.
They're a proud community, they have a proud history, and why shouldn't they be in charge of their own destiny?
Duff Mitchell is Business Development Director for Cascade Creek and a consultant to Angoon.
Now, Ruth Lake and Scenery Lake will produce cash revenues for them that city can use for whatever they want. They have one of the highest unemployments in Southeast Alaska. It's over 80%. They have one of the highest energy costs. And I applaud them for opening the door to look at how they can take care of themselves rather than ask others to take care of them.
He says Thayer Lake is also a good project, but it won't provide enough power for Angoon. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.